Hi, I'm Lauren Gilger, co-host of the show, one of KJZZ's original productions. It's a program with news and features from across Phoenix and the state. You can find much more at theshow.kjzz.org. Here's today's episode.
Good morning, and welcome to the show. On KJZZ 91.5 FM in Phoenix, I'm Sam Dingman. Coming up, reading the tea leaves about the future of the political partnership between Mexico and the U.S., and we'll investigate the origins of the peculiar piece of the pet cemetery. But first, friends, a question. How many of you are waking up every morning, grabbing your phone, and swiping through a stack of notifications that make it feel like the entire political landscape has been remade overnight? Perhaps more accurately, how many of you are doing that every hour on the hour? At this point in a presidential election cycle, it can feel like you are stuck at the foot of a mountain with a nonstop avalanche of breaking news boulders barreling towards you. Well, take heart, dear listener, because I am here with a college sophomore who feels the same way, but he has found a way to maintain sure footing amidst the shifting narrative sands. His name is George Headley, and he is the politics editor at State Press. George, I understand that back in high school, you had a fateful conversation with your mom.
I remember this very vividly. We were on a walk one night, and we both had like this crazy, like anxious conversation about like, you know, what if the next day, you know, something on the news like shows up and we can't really handle that or we can't really like think about it. So we took two different approaches, I think, from that night. She took the approach of, if I can't see it, it's not there. And I kind of took it as like, well, everything's going to be happening either way. And I need to take that responsibility and maybe, you know, show it to other people, you know? Right. So we took it in two different, very parallel perspectives.
Am I hearing your like origin story as a journalist right now? Like, was that because what you're describing is the work of a journalist.
Yeah.
You know, it's like, it's my job to engage with the information and then figure out how to reflect it back to people in a way that is a little bit more manageable. Was that the first time that thought occurred to you?
Yeah, absolutely. I just got really into the sense of like, I want to do this. Like, I want to be like that messenger, you know, take it as you want, but this is what's going on.
So can you give me an example of an early story that you wrote that was in that spirit?
Yeah, of course. I think the biggest one was, so I was writing for the State Press as a community and culture reporter for my first semester, and I was writing about the a safe space for LGBTQ plus organizations and people, like a place where everybody from different cultures can like interact and be in a place where they feel comfortable and safe, right? And the space wasn't being made, and previous offices or places for them were being closed off, basically.
Gotcha.
They were being used for like administrative offices and that kind of stuff. And I wanted to take it in a way where, okay, I have a privilege as a journalist to say this to a large group of people. And the idea was, here's what's going on. Here's the experiences, the issues that some people in these organizations have been experiencing with administration, you know, a call to action to the administration, be like, hey, you know, step up. Let's like really talk about this. Let's engage a conversation.
Yeah. So it's very stirring to me, you know, hearing you tell that story and like how much of an awakening it was for you to go from having this realization on the walk with your mom to doing that kind of coverage that answers that calling that you first felt. But you also in this piece are talking about something that I don't think maybe journalists in particular talk about as much, which is, like everybody else, even though you have this calling to be the messenger, as you put it, you talk about how you have your own tendency towards the doom scroll, towards just kind of letting the stories wash by and feeling like it would be detrimental to let this in because it could become demoralizing. So as a person with the journalistic calling to be the messenger and a human being and a college student dealing with this influx, how do you experience that tension and how do you get yourself out of it?
I noticed it very heavily during this summer specifically because, you know, I loved journalism because I loved writing, right? And I loved being a storyteller and loved telling narratives. But this summer, I was given the opportunity and the privilege to be the politics editor at the State Press.
Did anything happen in the
in politics this summer? I'm not. I'm just imagining, like, you know, if you're like a budding journalist and somebody's like, hey, do you want to be politics editor this summer? There's a presidential campaign going on. And you're like, sure. And then it's like, oh, here's something that's never happened before.
Yeah, no, it definitely felt like that, because I was like, you know, how do you really tackle that change? And being a college student, you know, fresh out of high school, it's like, I'm still learning. I still don't really know what I'm doing. And that does translate a lot into like, okay, well, neither does anyone else. This is the responsibility I was given. This is a job I need to do. So I'm going to do it. And it's a lot. It is a lot.
Yeah. What you're talking about, George, I have to say, is a kind of extraordinary level of self-awareness. Mm-hmm. Because you're right. You have chosen a life path that necessitates you being the eye of the storm.
Yeah. And I think a lot of people also deal with this when it comes to anxiety, is you never want to think about the future, right? You never want to think about what's ahead, because it does worry a lot of people and does stress them out. But I like to think, okay, I'm not there yet. I don't really know what's going to happen from it. So to worry about it, or to think about it in the way that, you know, oh my gosh, this is so huge, like this is so massive, we just don't know yet.
You're talking about something so nuanced right now. Let me make sure I understand. Yeah. Is that you feel the anxiety, mm-hmm, of knowing that what's happening is very intense and potentially world historical.
Yeah.
But you also know that sitting in that anxiety is not good for you.
Yeah.
And yet you also have the responsibility of trying to make the most educated calculation you can.
Yeah.
Of how people are going to look back at this. Are you saying that the attempt to make that calculation helps with the anxiety?
Yeah, it does a little bit, because when I'm making that calculated guess, it's usually never right.
I almost feel like you're saying, let's go ahead and acknowledge, like, yes, this is massive.
Yeah.
Let's treat it like history in the moment. Mm-hmm. And if in the future it turns out to not be significant, the worst that can be said is that we took it seriously.
Yeah, exactly.
I realize, you know, we're tilting in this conversation almost towards something that's too inside baseball, but like, yeah. I think the thing that isn't, hopefully, inside baseball, mm-hmm, about it is, I think what we're really talking about is it's an exercise in presence, mm-hmm, and finding a sense of purpose, keep maintaining a sense of purpose, and it's action-oriented. Mm-hmm. So that if the experience of information overwhelm for a lot of people is paralysis and despair, like, mm-hmm, what you're talking about is, no, there's a story to be told about this.
Yeah.
And I will tell that story.
If I'm going to think about this, and I'm going to think about it, you know, and I'm going to have anxiety about it, why not cover it? Right? I think that does help my anxiety a lot, is to just be involved, because I'm no longer thinking of it as a world-ending experience. I'm thinking of it as a story.
Wow. I think that is kind of at the core of what really resonated for me about your piece, is, mm-hmm, that, like, basically what you're talking about is agency.
Yes.
And how easy it is with the way the news is delivered now, and particularly during an election cycle, to feel like you don't have agency. Mm-hmm.
You know, when you look at an algorithm, especially on like TikTok or whatever, right, you think about it in the way businesses want you to think about it, where it's like, you know, we're going to give you exactly what you want. And sometimes for people, it's what they're most scared of, right? They're most scared of these things, and they want to be more informed about it, because if they're not informed about it, like me, it can create anxiety, and it creates this, you know, this more fear, because you don't really know what's going on. And the algorithm adapts to that. And when that happens, I think a lot of people are like, oh my gosh, the algorithm is targeting me, you know, with all these, like, basically these crazy things. But in all honesty, it's just its perception of you as a person and what news you want.
Yes. It's treating you like the message.
Yeah.
But you're the messenger.
Mm-hmm. It's pretty deep.
Well, George Headley will be sending me an invoice for therapy for this interview. And he's also the politics editor at State Press and a sophomore at the Walter Cronkite School of Journalism and Mass Communication at ASU. Thank you, George.
Thank you so much for having me.
Mexico has a new president. Claudia Sheinbaum is the first woman to become president of our neighbor to the south. She's a climate scientist who's the protege of Mexico's former leftist populist president, Andrés Manuel López Obrador. But where Obrador found an unlikely bromance with former U.S. President Donald Trump,
There is skepticism that Shane Baum would do the same if Trump wins in November. Mexico is also a major trading partner for the U.S. and the top trading partner for Arizona. And when it comes to the border and immigration, Shane Baum's role could be essential in working with the federal government here. My co-host, Lauren Gilger, spoke more about what we might expect from a Shane Baum presidency with Luis Coronado Gell, Director of Mexico Initiatives at the University of Arizona's College of Social and Behavioral Sciences.
She actually stated that she's going to pursue more policy of clean energy. And this is clearly one of the most important statements she made in distancing from the previous administration. It seems to me that seeing her profile as a scientist who studied abroad, it looks to me that she's going to emphasize more that side. And also she declared, you know, related to Pemex, the national oil company, that she plans actually to reduce the production just for the national consume, which actually is very different to what AMLO stated in his term.
Right. So some big differences, it sounds like, on climate, which makes sense coming from her background. Let me ask you about some potential differences in how she might deal with a Trump administration versus a Harris administration, right? AMLO and President Trump had this interesting relationship that was often referred to as a bromance, right? Might we expect a similar relationship between Trump and Shane Baum if Trump were to win?
You know, from my point of view, we see even a generational renewal. I mean, Shane Baum, she's the first woman in office, but also she's a scientist and she's also younger than AMLO. So I see that this camaraderie you saw between AMLO and Trump is not likely to be the same, obviously, because of these gender differences, right? And the approach to gender they have. In terms of kind of public policy, it seems to me that there will be a continuation of certain uses and customs with the United States. Although, you know, President Sheinbaum declared that she's going to wait to have a formal interview, her first formal interview with an American president, once she knows who is going to be the winner.
Right.
So this actually changes a lot, kind of this relation AMLO used to have with Ambassador Ken Salazar, and also with this new potential administrator, whether it's Harris or Trump.
So I want to ask you about two major issues that Shane Baum will be dealing with when it comes to the U.S., which are immigration and trade. Let's start with immigration and the rhetoric around it. I wonder, like, I know immigration is a sensitive topic in Mexico. I also know that AMLO did a lot to crack down on immigration on Mexico's southern border when he was in office. How does each American candidate's kind of rhetoric on immigration land in Mexico?
Well, I think immigration and economy goes along, and one of the policies that AMLO put in place to deal with immigration in the first place was sending 28,000 soldiers to the southern border of Mexico to control the immigrants from Central America and other parts in South America, and that seems likely to continue. And the enforcement in the northern states, I think, is going to continue the same. Although we have seen in this first month of Sheinbaum that the majority of Morena in the Congress of Mexico, they have passed a reform, an important reform, to put the National Guard under the Secretary of Defense control. So this has a lot of implications on how Mexico will deal now with immigration. And definitely this will impact the way in which both candidates, Harris and Trump, are approaching the immigration issue. And we have seen in both cases that both Trump and Kamala Harris have been visiting the border, stating that they need to enforce and reinforce the border, which has been a constant in both campaigns. So I think it's definitely an issue that it will come into some sort of result for electors in the United States.
Let me ask you about trade then. I mean, obviously, that's a hugely important part of Mexico's economy, trade with the U.S. It's usually an important part of Arizona's economy, trade with Mexico. I know Sheinbaum's party's policies have expanded welfare programs in Mexico, and all of that kind of depends on that U.S.-Mexico trade relationship. Tell us how she might approach that and the upcoming review of the USMCA trade deal next year.
Well, definitely. I mean, what we have seen in both candidates in the United States, both Harris and Trump had stated kind of a similar approach to the USMCA treaty. Both of them have openly said that they will pursue a review of the treaty. And obviously, all the reforms that Mexico is now going through, they are going to affect some way or another the way that the USMCA is working at this point. And considering China right now as this kind of outsider, right, and that it's trying to establish investments also in Mexico, if these rules change in the future, obviously some investors probably will look over other points for investment rather than Mexico. So I think we are in front of a certain uncertainty, let's say that. It's very uncertain at this point to see what is going to happen.
Yeah.
But both approaches from both candidates are kind of similar.
From an Arizona perspective, I mean, do you think there are things that local trade representatives from our state government are going to be looking at with this new administration in Mexico?
What I have seen locally is that, you know, in many ways, local investors from Sonora and Arizona, they keep cooperating. And actually, recently, probably 6 or 8 months ago, Governor Durazo and Governor Hobbs signed an important agreement on semiconductors. So if you see that along with all the investment in solar energy near to Puerto Peñasco and other areas in Sonora that are directly connected with the interests of the United States in the border, we can see that the relation between Arizona and Sonora is going to continue. Mm-hmm. And the rhetorics between the national politicians usually are more related to national elections, right? So in my opinion, we will see that all this inflammatory rhetoric is going to end once we have someone else in office, because there are so many different interests going on back and forth in Arizona and Sonora.
All right, we'll leave it there. Luis Coronado Gil joining us, Director of Mexico Initiatives at the University of Arizona College of Social and Behavioral Sciences. Luis, thank you for coming on. Thanks for your expertise here. I appreciate it.
Thank you, Lauren.
Good morning. It's the show on KJZZ 91.5 FM in Phoenix. I'm Sam Dingman. Coming up, rabbits, pigs, sheep, and other livestock animals are strutting across the Arizona State Fairgrounds. But first, maybe this has happened to you. You're at a party or a celebration, and among the snacks, there are foods with someone's photo on them, maybe a cake or cookies. And maybe you felt a little apprehensive about cutting a slice or taking a bite out of that photo food. If so, you are not alone. New research from ASU finds there appear to be some limits to the billion-dollar photo integration industry. Items like magnets, pillows, and bags, those seem to be fine. But more disposable items, like foods and even napkins, people seem a little more squeamish about eating or using those. Adriana Samper is an associate professor of marketing in ASU's W.P. Carey School of Business and one of the authors of the paper. She spoke with my co-host Mark Brody about what they found, and they started with how prevalent these personalized products are, where there's an actual photo of an actual human on an actual product.
Yeah, no, it's something that it's always kind of occurred, but now with advances in technology, it's very common in gift giving. If you've ever gone to Shutterfly, if you've ever, even on your phone, there's a variety of apps that you can use to personalize items. And for a long time, it was mostly more durable items, you know, mugs, blankets. I've seen cushions, pillows, throw pillows. But now there seems to be a greater focus on items that are more novel, disposable items like M&Ms or some napkins or cookies. So it's something that's growing in prevalence. but it's often used either as a gift, a promotional material, kind of a celebratory event. I've seen images of, you know, graduation type photos, somebody with a cap and gown on that you can use as a gift.
Yeah. Well, so perhaps not surprisingly, you found that, you know, some people at least have kind of an aversion to like taking a bite out of an item that has a picture of a friend or family member on it, or cutting into a cake that has, you know, a family or friend's face on it. And I guess, like, as I said, it's not entirely surprising. And yet, as you say, these items are increasingly popular.
Absolutely. I think one thing that I'm always interested in is studying how people might anticipate purchasing something for the novelty, and they have expectations of what it'll be like to consume, how cool it might be. But then when the consumption actually happens, it's not what they were expecting. They're more uncomfortable. They eat, if it's a cookie, they'll eat less of it. They'll consume fewer M&Ms. They won't even use napkins in the same way, even though these napkins were purchased specifically for a special event, celebrating perhaps an individual. But we get this sense that there's a disconnect between what people expect and what they actually consume and what they experience.
So your research finds that people have what you're calling a moral discomfort with some of this. And I'm wondering, what exactly are people uncomfortable about when they are eating something or maybe using something that they're going to throw away that has a picture of somebody that they know and love on it?
So the discomfort emerges from this notion of kind of a twofold dimension of, first, it feels a little disrespectful, right, to kind of consume in a way that's destroying something or a person that you care about. And that disrespect is also something that translates into, okay, I don't want to do this. I'm uncomfortable destroying something that is kind of a living entity, a living being. And so to that end, we actually find the effect not just with specific individuals or loved ones, but even with a kitten or an image of a sacred item like the Bible.
Do you have a sense of where the line is in terms of these kinds of products that people are comfortable using versus not? Like, I, for example, have made coasters for family members, like with my kid's picture on it to send to their grandparents. And I wonder, like, would people feel uncomfortable, like, putting a glass on it and, like, leaving a ring or, like, having some kind of beverage spill on it, you know, when it's the face of their grandchild versus, for example, like, eating a cookie with a family member's face on it?
Absolutely. Yeah. So that's one thing that we studied because we were very curious about this. And when it's durable, when it's enduring, then you consuming it isn't changing the image. It's not marring it. Like, you're not immediately seeing this marring of the image and in turn kind of eliciting moral discomfort. And so more durable products, I don't know if you've seen like save the dates with magnets on them, images with magnets on them. Magnets with images on them, those types of products, people really enjoy consuming, they enjoy getting them, they enjoy consuming them. And so these effects are not there for those. It's specifically these disposable items which have grown in popularity, in part because it's like, oh, wow, they could put an image on a cookie, but yet that creates this discomfort down the line when you actually have to consume the product with the image on it.
So for people who buy these, you mentioned a lot of times that they're bought as gifts. Do the givers not realize that people will have this discomfort with them? Like, I just imagine buying a cake with, you know, family member's picture on it and then serving it and realizing, oh, gosh, like, I can't eat this and neither can anybody else.
Yeah, no. So it is really interesting because we were considering that as well. And we had a study at the end where we had people think about actually consuming it. And so when you think about consuming a product, then you expect that your guest who might consume the product is going to like it less when it has a photo on it. But when you're not thinking about it, like you're just seeing the image, you're like, oh, that's kind of cool, that's kind of neat. And so because consumption itself of the item is decoupled from just seeing it and purchasing it, then you can get this disconnect between what you think is cool and what people will enjoy consuming.
How do you think the companies that provide these products should take this research to the extent they're going to use it and incorporate it into their businesses? How do you think they ought to do that?
Absolutely. So there are a few things we think are important takeaways. First, this does impact word of mouth. And so it's something purchase. So if you see something like this, then maybe you didn't buy it, but it was given to you and you are actually seeing this product, you're less likely to say like, oh, I'm going to recommend that to a friend, or I'm going to purchase this for myself in the future. And so we recommend something like, if you're going to use these items, first recognize that if it's a buzz type of campaign where you're not reliant on consumption, maybe just for promotional materials, maybe accepting the fact that it's not going to be consumed, which isn't ideal. But if you are trying to do something with selling people products, actually having a cartoon representation might be something that will lead to higher consumption rates and interest in consumption. And in addition, if you're trying to decide what types of products to photo customize, the more durable ones, tins, magnets, things like that, can actually be seen as more enduring and more enjoyable to consume and more likely to be consumed once the purchase is done and the individuals have these products.
Sure. All right. That is Adriana Samper, an associate professor of marketing in ASU's W.P. Carey School of Business. Adriana, thank you so much for the conversation. I appreciate it.
Thank you so much for the opportunity. Have a great day.
Good morning. You're listening to The Show on KJZZ 91.5 FM in Phoenix. I'm Sam Dingman.
A few years ago, my wife and I were driving around southwestern Utah looking for this slot canyon that we wanted to go hiking in. At some point, we made what we thought was the last turn for the trailhead, and instead found ourselves driving along this winding road that led to a parking lot. And when we got out of the car, we found ourselves face to face, not with the trailhead, but rather a set of iron gates and a sign that said Angel's Rest. We checked our phones and discovered that we had somehow accidentally ended up at one of the world's most famous pet cemeteries. So we decided to go in and take a look around. As we walked through the gates, there was a little breeze in the air and the sound of wind chimes. They were beautiful. I took out my phone and started recording. We wandered along stone pathways lined with engraved bricks and slabs of clay. There were hundreds of them, with inscriptions addressed to dearly departed pets. They said things like, "Jack, sweet dreams, my precious baby. Until we meet again, Mom. In loving memory of sweet Dino, part goat, all heart." Now, my wife and I don't have any pets, but we ended up staying at Angel's Rest for like an hour. There was just a power to the place. In the years since that afternoon, I have often thought about that feeling. It's not like it was my first time in a cemetery, but something about Angel's Rest felt different, and I could never put my finger on what it was until I met Paul Koudinaris.
I will try my best to keep the cats from jumping on the computer.
Koudinaris isn't just a pet owner. He literally wrote the book on pet cemeteries. It's called Faithful Unto Death: Pet Cemeteries, Animal Graves, and Eternal Devotion. Koudinaris spent over 10 years traveling the world studying animal burial rituals. He is fascinated by the grief we feel for our pets, in part because they occupy this kind of liminal space. We treat them as something more than animal, but less than human. It's a unique relationship, which may be why pet cemeteries have become unique spaces. If you read the inscriptions on the graves at a place like Angel's Rest, you don't find much of the matter-of-fact, emotionally detached writing you see in a human graveyard. Instead of, "Here lies John, husband, father, hero," you get stuff like, "Part goat, all heart." A pet cemetery is a place to feel the real feelings that death makes you feel, no matter how uncomfortable or awkward. Case in point, a pet headstone in Ajo, Arizona, which features one of Paul Kudinaris's all-time favorite inscriptions.
It says, Ringo, you were the best dog. Everybody loved you except Uncle Ted. F*** Uncle Ted.
That kind of honesty, Kudinaris says, is why places like Angel's Rest feel so special. There's no self-consciousness. It's a place where it's okay to be vulnerable.
And it's so open and it's so pure. I think it's just such a more pure form of expression and emotion.
When you walk around a pet cemetery, you're practically guaranteed to see references to something called the Rainbow Bridge. I saw them all over the place at Angel's Rest. One inscription in particular said, "To all my pets, rest in peace. See you at the Rainbow Bridge. I love and miss you all."
The Rainbow Bridge is this meeting place. It's kind of like a bridge to paradise. And when an animal dies, it will wait for us at the bridge.
The idea comes from a poem, which many people discovered in the 1990s when it was published without attribution in a Dear Abby advice column. At the time, Dear Abby had a readership in the tens of millions. And since then, thanks to the internet, the Rainbow Bridge has spread all over the world. But until last year, nobody knew who wrote the poem, until Paul Kudinaris tracked down Edna Klein Recke.
She is in her 80s. She lives in Scotland. She wrote it when she was a teenager, when a dog that she owned named Major died.
Edna was distraught and tore a page out of her sister's notebook.
And she said she could feel the dog writing through her hand, telling her what to write.
The unsigned poem eventually got passed around without Edna's knowledge until it found its way to Dear Abby. Kudinaris thinks it caught on because most religions don't really have much to say about the fate of animal souls.
We have always spiritually lacked, especially in the West, a way to get these animals into paradise.
The Rainbow Bridge, like the pet cemetery, fills an emotional void. It's given countless people language to express their feelings of loss. And Kudinaris says that for Edna Klein Recke, that feeling is more than enough. She doesn't mourn the loss of whatever fame or fortune she might have earned from having her name associated with the Rainbow Bridge. On some level, she's still mourning the loss of Major.
Every time someone quotes Edna, every time someone republishes those words, it's also a tribute to her dog that she loved.
That feeling will have to be enough until Edna herself passes away and she and Major are reunited. At least if her poem is to be believed. This is how it ends. The nose twitches, the ears are up, the eyes are staring. And this one suddenly runs from the group. You have been seen, and when you and your special friend meet, you take him or her in your arms and embrace. Your face is kissed again and again and again, and you look once more into the eyes of your trusting pet. Then you cross the Rainbow Bridge together, never again to be separated. Special thanks to Paul Kudinaris. His book is Faithful Unto Death. For KJZZ's The Show, I'm Sam Dingman. Good morning, it's The Show on KJZZ 91.5 FM in Phoenix. I'm Sam Dingman. When Beetlejuice was released in 1988, viewers noticed a lot of fun, practical effects in the movie. Because Beetlejuice came out before CGI got popular, the effects were created with physical techniques instead of computers. 36 years later, CGI is everywhere. Michael Keaton said he would only return to his role as the film's titular character if the sequel prioritized old-school handmade effects. With the proliferation of computer-generated effects in today's movies, we thought it'd be interesting to talk about the evolution of special effects in movies over the past few decades. To do that, my co-host Mark Brody spoke with Susan Weeks, VFX professor at ASU's Sidney Poitier New American Film School. And just for reference, VFX stands for visual effects, which are done on computers. That's opposed to special effects, which are generally done on set. And they started there, with a look at how VFX has changed since people first started doing this.
Well, when people first started doing this, they performed something called compositing, where you marry one piece of footage to another piece of footage through an optical printer. They would create mats and then put two pieces of film together, and that's how they, you know, would put in map paintings or whatever, up until about 1982 or 83, when computers started coming into play in creating visual effects. And they didn't really come roaring into the scene until about 1990.
Hmm. Well, so once computers started really being used, I would imagine, like most things with computers, the technology kind of took off, and the cool things that people like you could do kind of took off too.
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. It's been growing exponentially. I've had to learn so much software over the years because it keeps evolving, you know?
So when you go back and look to, like, let's say the mid 80s, let's say, when some of this, you know, when the very early versions of this were being done, and then let's say the early 90s when the computer stuff started happening, like, what do you see through, you know, the lens of your eyes compared to what you're able to do now?
I see a lot of limitations, but I also see a lot of really great work. For example, the Jurassic Park movies, you know, those movies still stand up really well. And they were the foundational visual effects films that we first saw. And now I think visual effects has become kind of a hammer sort of tool. You know, people use it to fix everything in their film instead of, you know, carefully planning it and getting it right. Now we're doing things like changing the timing of actors and putting scenes in the 50s and 60s, things like that. It's more invisible than it was before. Now you can be looking at some film or something and there'll be loads of visual effects in it, but you'll never know because they're so invisible. So the purpose has really changed. We've moved from the big old huge CGI characters to kind of more everyday sorts of effects, as well as these over-the-top effects movies. I'm thinking of the Marvel Universe movies where pretty much everything in the shot is a visual effect except for the actor.
Well, that's a really interesting point because at least for me as sort of a movie outsider, when I think visual effects, I think of things that are done for the purpose of the audience knowing and noticing that they're being done, not, as you're describing, things that the audience would have no way of knowing were done as visual effects.
Right. That's exactly right. And that's always been part of it. The invisible part of it has always been part of visual effects, but now filmmakers are using it to, you know, save time on the set.
Well, so to you then, does that sort of take away from the filmmaking or the storytelling if directors and producers can just fix everything sort of on computers as opposed to what the actors are actually doing on set?
For me, it does. I kind of don't like to do that kind of work because I think directors should just get it right on the set. They should work with the actors and just, you know, get it right on the set because it's expensive to do that. It's very fiddly to do that. And I think a lot of people are overusing it quite a bit. I worked on a film recently where it was no reason to do that, but they did that anyway. They would take, you know, one actor from one footage and another actor from another footage and put them together just to fix whatever they thought was wrong. So yeah, I am kind of against that. I prefer using visual effects to, you know, enhance the story in some way to make it more believable or more fantastic, however you want to do it. For me, visual effects is about storytelling, not necessarily technique.
Yeah. Well, so what is the rationale for doing that? Because as you say, it's kind of expensive to do, and I would imagine it's fairly time-consuming to have you fix some of this stuff afterwards. So why do directors and producers decide to do it that way?
It saves time on the set. That's the only reason to do it, is that they can get through their shooting schedule a lot quicker if they're not worried about, you know, getting everything just right. They know that we have the tools to, you know, fix their backgrounds or remove that cube truck or, you know, change the timing or, you know, take out the markings on the street. They know we can do that, and it saves them enormous time on the set.
So I won't ask you to name names unless you want to, but are there particular directors that seem to do sort of find the right balance between using visual effects and making sure that the storytelling happens on set to the extent that you think it should?
Yes, absolutely. You know, the one that comes to my mind right away is Christopher Nolan.
Mm-hmm.
He's really great about doing that. He has used CGI with tremendous effect in a lot of his movies.
So when you watch a movie, are you watching, I'm sure you're watching for plot and storylines and dialogue mm-hmm. and all that stuff, but are you also watching to try to see, okay, this actually happened on set, this happened in post, this is how they did it, and trying to sort of dissect the making of the movie also?
Always. I'm always doing that. I can't ever watch a film without my disbelief being, not suspended.
Yeah. Does that bother the people with whom you're watching the movies? Do they ever tell you, just, shh, I want to watch it. I want to let me disbelieve. You don't have to, but I want to.
I try to be, thoughtful about the people I watch films with. And not go. I think it to myself. I don't necessarily say it out loud until after the film is over.
Okay.
Because that drives me crazy when I'm watching it with somebody who has to talk through the whole film and have all these comments about it. I prefer to wait till after the movie before we start talking about it, and then I can point things out and then it's fun.
That is fair. So I'm curious what you think the future of visual effects and CGI looks like. Like if we go to the movies in 3 years, 5 years, 10 years from now, what are we going to be seeing that we're maybe not seeing now?
Maybe a lot more virtual sets. Maybe, right now they do a lot of filming in front of green screens as opposed to going out on location. And I think we're developing more skillfully how to use virtual sets where we have the actors act in front of an LED screen that has the background for them carefully designed by, world designers. I think we'll see more of that. I hope we see more creature work. I always love creature work in CGI. I think that could only get better. It's only ever gotten better. It's never gotten worse. So those are some of the things that I see. The use of virtual production is one of the biggest ones, I think.
All right. That is Susan Weeks, a VFX professor at ASU Sydney Poitier New American Film School. Susan, nice to talk to you. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Mark.
For months, kids and teenagers across Arizona have been breeding and raising pigs, rabbits, chickens, sheep, goats, and cows. Earlier this month at the Arizona State Fair, a lucky few got a shot at being the best of the best. Most livestock competitions at the State Fair are judged on the appearance of the animal, but the show's Amber Victoria Singer reports that the final contest is more about how that appearance is presented.
In the back corner of the fairgrounds, past the cyclone, mini bumper cars, balloon pop, and fried frog legs, right behind the big Ferris wheel, is the Agriculture Center and Cattle Barn. The State Fair's Agriculture Center looks like a cross between a barn and a warehouse. Inside the tall, domed, air-conditioned building on a recent Saturday afternoon, families sitting in camping chairs cluster around hundreds of sheep, goats, and pigs. It's Youth Week, which means the building is swarming with 6 to 19-year-old 4-H and Future Farmers of America members. It's a sea of neckties, flared jeans, and huge decorative belt buckles. On the other side of the barn, kids are leading animals into brown metal enclosures behind a makeshift stage area. They're getting ready for Karen Searle's favorite competition. She's the director of fair entries.
Today, the round robin competition is the best against the best. So it's the best pig showman against the best goat showman and sheep showman and beef showman. They have to show species they may have never shown before, all to win the title of round robin champion.
The stage is a fenced-in rectangle of concrete covered in sawdust. As the brown bleachers start to fill up, 13-year-old Balin Johnson stands in an enclosure with three goats, looking around nervously. She's wearing a white long-sleeve button-up with a teal necktie and white pants. Her belt has a huge silver buckle with turquoise accents and an Arizona flag. It says champion because Johnson is this year's Arizona State Fair Intermediate Champion Dairy Goat Showman. This doesn't mean she had the best goat. It means she did the best job showing off her goats.
This one right here is Avi. That one is called Bud, and that's Paloma. I don't know the names of those two. Mm-hmm.
How long have you been raising animals for?
Since I was basically born.
After checking in at the judges' table, 18 competitors across three age groups line up to be introduced.
Dairy Goat Department, Balin Johnson, Western's first.
All except one contestant, whose pants don't have belt loops, wear their champion belt buckles. Competitors show the species and then answer questions from the judges. Things like, How many stomachs does this have? What's its natural market weight? What do you feed it? Each animal is shown a little differently. The goal is to show all sides of the animal while maintaining eye contact with the judges. For goats and sheep, the kids hold the creature's heads up and reposition their legs. For swine, long, skinny whips are used to gently guide the pigs around the enclosure. A few competitors have to rush after runaway pigs. Throughout each round, one thing stands out about Baylin Johnson. She's the only contestant grinning from ear to ear. Another competitor, 12-year-old Mary Edwards, who is the junior champion meat goat showman, says it's not a good idea to smile while showing livestock.
You kind of have to look a little mean to win.
According to Xavier Arias, one of the judges, this is a big part of the score.
What kids make eye contact and are showing that competitiveness and don't break eye contact and consistently have their goats set up and are in the right positions.
As she shows each animal, Edwards lowers her chin and locks eyes with the judges, staring them down. And as for how she prepares to show animals she hasn't raised herself?
I go around the couple of days beforehand and I ask people who have shown their animals really well and I try to get info from them.
The dairy and beef cattle portion of the competition takes place in a different, smaller, smellier barn. On one side is a maze of dozens of cows and pens. On the other side, two types of cattle are lined up on opposite sides of what looks like a tiny arena. Two age divisions at a time lead the two types of cattle in a wide circle around the judges before answering questions about the animals. After tallying the scores, the judges announce the winners.
In third place, the
Baylin Johnson earns a modest third place. She smiles politely at Arizona Miss Agriculture, who is wearing a large crown and a bright pink jacket, as she accepts her ribbon. Mary Edwards crosses her fingers when it's time to announce the winner of the junior division. It's down to her and one other competitor. When she's competing, all that's going through her head is...
You better win.
Our grand champion is going to go to Mary Edwards from the meatball.
Edwards bounces toward Miss Agriculture to accept her buckle and ribbon. She says this is the third round robin competition she's won in her 5 years of raising animals. How did you feel when they announced that you won?
I'm really excited and happy.
This is her 22nd belt buckle. For KJZZ's The Show, I'm Amber Victoria Singer.
Although there aren't any more competitions quite as exciting as the round robin, a variety of animals, including winning livestock, will be on display to the public through the end of the state fair. The last day to go is October 27th. Well, let's see here. Self-perception, U.S.-Mexico relations, novelty cakes, animal showmen, animal souls, just another typical Wednesday here at the show. Thanks for listening along with us. For Mark Brody and Lauren Gilger, I am your humble human showman, Sam Dingman. We'll be back here at 9 a.m. tomorrow. Thank you so much.
That's it for this episode of The Show podcast. To find out more about the stories from today or other episodes, visit theshow.kjzz.org. And you can subscribe to KJZZ's The Show on your favorite podcasting site. I'm Mark Brody. Thanks for listening today.